This is not really Mirko Krokop, but you are listening to Top Turtle MMA Podcast, Episode 2. Right Leg Hospital, Left Leg Cemetery. Pride never dies. Alright, we are rolling. This is Top Turtle, Episode 2. I am David Tremonti, your host, and I am joined, as always, by Daniel Gumby Vreeland, the co-editor of MMAManifesto.com. Gumby is off a late night. He went to the fights in Boston last night. How are you, Gumby?
I'm tired. Arrived back at in my hometown at 3 in the morning, thanks to a little bit of snow, a lot of bit of traffic, and some very, very tired eyes.
But it was all worth it, right?
Definitely all worth it. Awesome environment, Boston, every single time you go. Occasionally, the Boobirds come out a little bit heavy in Boston because they like their action. And when it gets a little stale or when it turns into like a technical boxing match like that main event was, sometimes they're a little quick to judge.
At the end, there was some cheering, I thought, at the end, like a bit of a double standing O for both competitors as they're going to the bell.
There was definitely a standing O in the fifth round.
In the fifth round, right.
But there was also like some awkward booing in the second and third rounds.
I remember that, yeah.
And it was really like, I was trying to figure out why they were booing, because it was a very technical, very well put together match. And they booed at some other matches too, where I was like, if you knew anything about the ground game, there would be no way that you would boo.
Definitely in Alvarez Pettis, the Boo Birds came out.
Oh, yeah. Well, I mean, I think that's because of the way that they hyped that fight. They hyped that fight as like an awesome kickboxing, they're going to slug, that kind of thing. And it wound up being, you know, a grappling match where he just tried to hold Pettis down. He did a good job of it, but that's what he was doing.
Right. So this is episode 2, Gumby. Our pilot got picked up. We had our first episode last week. What did you think of episode 1, and are you happy to be back for episode 2?
So I listened to it again, really happy with the product. Obviously, a couple of places we could nip and tuck things to make it a little bit more smooth.
I have to say, I felt like I was on a job interview. I didn't curse the entire time. I used the word welcome to start the show. I've never used the word welcome. I've never greeted anyone as welcome. I feel like we're going to be more ourselves today.
I think I said crap a couple of times. I don't think I've said crap since I was 12.
Right.
So that's awkward. I should probably just go ahead and say shit, get that off the way, and now everything will be fine from here on out.
So should we give a little hat tip to our sponsors as well?
Yeah, let's give a little hat tip to a new sponsor for us, GrapplerToolbox.com. They do excellent packages that they will ship to you. You can even time the shipment so that you get them once a month, every other month, or something like that, so that if you are the type of person who needs that soap for your smelly, smelly ghee, or if you need the balm that's going to keep the ringworm off your skin, they will make sure that you have it and you don't forget to replenish.
So this is basically like, if anyone's familiar with man crates, this is like a man crate for grapplers.
That's right. And as one of our official sponsors, they are willing to give you 15% off if at the checkout counter you enter promo code MANIFESTO. That's like MMA Manifesto, only we drop the MMA out. Just Manifesto.
And you get 15% off, people. Don't wait. Run. So we are part of MMAManifesto.com. You can stream our show on the website, MMA-Manifesto.com. But you can also subscribe to us in iTunes and
TuneIn, SoundCloud. There's a whole bunch of ways to get at us now. So just go ahead and find the site that works best for you and click subscribe, and you'll get us once a week in your living room.
Top Turtle is omnipotent. We are everywhere, people. And you can also reach us via the email at topturtlemma@gmail.com. And we are also on the Twitter, topturtlemma, @topturtlemma.
And you can follow me on Twitter. That's @GumbyVreeland, VReeland.
All right, now that the heavy lifting's out of the way, I'm happy to announce we have a kick-ass show today. We have Jared Rochalt.
Speaking of heavy, I think, yeah.
I see what you did there.
That's a big guy. He's fighting at UFC 196, fighting Roy Nelson, so a really big fight for him.
As the Brazilians would say, Roy Nelson, and that is his biggest fight to date. And we also have Misha Cirkunov,
awesome prospect at 205. I know I've been telling you about him for a while. He knocked out Daniel Jolly in his debut. He's also fighting on UFC 196, and he'll be fighting newcomer Alex Nicholson, so we'll get a chance to talk to him a little bit about that.
If you have not seen Misha, and when Gumby said we have Misha on the podcast, I got really excited because I have a crush on Misha Tate.
Yeah, definitely not Misha Tate. He looks very different.
Very different, but you can check out his first fight. I actually forgot about it. It was part of a prelim on Holloway Oliveira back in the fall.
Yeah.
And when I went back and rewatched it, I go, oh yeah, that guy.
Yeah, Serginov, awesome judo, awesome grappling. One of the most fun prospects at 205, and you're definitely going to want to listen to that interview later.
So we will switch now to what brought us to the dance, so to speak. The main body of our show is breaking down UFC Fight Night 81 live from TD Garden last night. I think we're all a little strung out, late night for everyone staying up to watch the main event. But, you know, we'll start there. Honestly, one of my favorite fights maybe ever, to be honest with you. The movement from both guys, back and forth, razor thin.
Yeah, I hate to say I totally so, but that head work from Cruz is a whole different animal. And I think being away for so long, I mean, we haven't seen that head work in 4 years because he didn't use it against Mizugaki. He didn't have to.
Right.
And so we haven't seen it since he beat, who does he beat, Mighty Mouse?
Mighty Mouse was in 2011.
Yeah, so since he beat Mighty Mouse in 2011, we have not seen head movement like that from anybody.
And then also, I was thinking of something we talked about in the podcast last week, which, by the way, Dana White talked about his top four main event potentials for UFC 200. We nailed it before he said that.
All four of them.
Pat myself on the back on that. But I remember you saying that you didn't worry about ring rust out of Dominick Cruz. And, you know, there really was, I mean, you could have told me he fought 4 months ago and I would have believed it.
I think actually it was the opposite of that. In the beginning, he was the most comfortable. He seemed to get less comfortable as the fight went on, in my opinion. Because, I mean, okay, so now we're moving into the judges' scorecard talk. I had it, and I might be a dissenting opinion here, I thought Dominick Cruz won all three of the first rounds. I had him losing the fourth definitively, and I had a flip-flop on the fifth. I said, you know, you could give Cruz the fifth. I think because I was just so jacked up, I gave him the fifth. In that case, I am in agreement with the second judge. The second judge who gave three rounds to Cruz, he gave him 1, 2, and 3, didn't give him 4 and 5.
It's so tough for me to score, especially, I mean, I'm a massive fan of Joe Rogan. I am obviously, I get a little swayed by when he starts, you know, going with one of his kind of tangents or what he's seeing. But this is definitely one of those cases, much like Shogun versus Machida. I need to go back, watch with the sound off. If we go to the fight metric, though, it seems like I think the judges got this right, or at least two out of the three of them got it right. When you look at significant strikes thrown and landed each round, Cruz had a higher percentage of significant strikes thrown and landed in each round, actually.
Yeah.
And I do agree with you. I think Dillashaw won 4 and 5, which is why, and now we'll get into the rematch talk perhaps, I want to see a rematch. Dillashaw won the fourth and final round, or the fourth and fifth round. If you go to schoolyard rules, whoever is on top when the teacher says stop that won the fight in your junior high and high school. I feel the same way. I don't know. I feel bad for TJ. I want to see a rematch.
I would say, yeah, he definitely was winning at the end. And yeah, I get the need to want to see rematches all the time here. But if the people who keep calling for rematches had their way every time, the rematchaholics, if you will, had their way, we'd have 6 divisions right now tied up in rematches.
Yeah.
And that's not counting the fact that Jon Jones is technically getting a rematch against Daniel Cormier.
Right.
And then that would be 7. Dillashaw, who would be earning one. Brousey would be earning one. Aldo would be earning one.
Weidman would be
Weidman,
one.
Condit.
Kane is getting one.
Kane is getting one, and Jones would be getting one. That is 70% of your divisions. You can't do that. It's just not, it doesn't make any sense.
I mean, we were talking off air, and I'm going to steal this directly from you, and I just could not agree more with it. As the sport evolves, and we get better athletes and better fighters, and, you know, this happened in baseball, too, with pitching mechanics and hitting mechanics, as you get coaches like a Dwayne Bang Ludwig breaking everything down, year over year, we're going to get closer and closer fights.
Especially at the top. You might not get that in the prelims. You might not get that in the middle of the card. You might not even get that in the early main card. But in the main events, the difference between the best in the world and the second best in the world is getting smaller. You're going to suffocate some of the young talent. I've mentioned this to you before. I think having that young talent get suffocated is killing people like Aljamain Sterling. Aljamain Sterling is my pick for the next shot of Cruz. And no.
And by the way, sorry to interrupt, but he was at the fights last night while negotiating a contract, so I look at that as a good sign.
I would say that's definitely positive.
Yeah, I hope they re-sign him.
I think not only are they re-signing him, but they're considering him for either the title fight or the number one contender fight. Because him, Sun Tzu, and Faber were there, and you got to imagine one of them's getting the title fight, the other two are fighting each other. And where the UFC goes with that, it's up to them.
You can, so, and again, we talked about this off air. We have to stop talking off air and just save everything.
Yeah,
for right
I thought the same thing.
But listen, so you could go in one of two ways here. You could do the WWE Pro Wrestling Grudge match, Dillashaw versus Faber, while Cruz fights the young lion in Aljamain Sterling, and then winners face off. Or you could go with Cruz versus Faber, which is their money fight, and they probably want to get out of the way, and just have Aljamain Sterling fight TJ Dillashaw.
Well, and I will say the other thing in there, too, is so Aljamain Sterling, if you put him with Cruz, the other option is that Dillashaw could fight a Sun Tzu, and yeah, you're leaving Faber out in the cold here, but Faber also has a rib injury that he has yet to see the doctor on. He said it might be bruised, it might be broken, he might have a cracked rib of some sort.
Mm-hmm.
He's like, oh, I just haven't had time to see the doctor. Well, it's time to see the doctor because we need to know while we're booking these fights,
right,
which
and
way we're going.
Let's also not forget that Cruz looked a little worse for wear by the time that fight was over.
Yeah, limping on that leg was a little bit scary.
Yeah,
I thought you might even sway the judge out a round or two there when I saw him walking like that at the end. It looked like he was going to need crutches.
I really hope he does not get injured again.
If that's a torn ACL or an MCL or something, I'll cry.
I don't even mean to laugh. Yeah, it would be awful for him.
No, but you're laughing because it's comical at this point.
Yeah.
It is comical at this point that he's broken that often while being one of the greatest fighters in the world.
Yeah.
So I know you got the card up right there. One of the things I do remember now that I've given a second to think about it is that two of those judges gave Dillashaw the first round, which was very surprising to me. But the judge that gave Cruz four rounds gave Dillashaw the first. Is that correct? You're looking at it right now.
Yeah, that is absolutely correct.
Which is weird to me, because let's talk about this for a second. The only round I thought Dillashaw won definitively was the fourth, and then I thought probably he won the fifth.
Yeah, agree.
The guy who gave Dillashaw four rounds, which first of all I think is a travesty, gave Cruz the second. So Cruz is definitively the second. I think he probably won the first and third. I thought Dillashaw was definitively the fourth, and you know, the fifth, probably Dillashaw, could have been a toss-up.
I'm sorry, Sal D'Amato gave Dillashaw four rounds. And just Cruz the second, which is absolutely ridiculous, because
yeah,
the third was Cruz's round.
And you know, when I heard the last judge's scorecard that said Cruz got four of them, four rounds, 49-46, I was like, right, that's exactly how I had it. But then the card came out this morning, and I read it, and I was like, wait a second, they gave Dillashaw the first? Of all of the rounds you could have given him, you gave him the first? Because definitely the fourth, I thought probably the fifth, the first?
MMA judging, people. I mean, listen, I agree with you and everything you say. I don't want to keep clogging up divisions with rematches, but to me, if there was ever a reason for a rematch, it's off a champion losing via split decision, which has only happened one other time in UFC history. All right, let's move to...
Speaking of sketchy scorecards.
Pettis Alvarez. So, I mean, I think the majority of people probably saw it for Alvarez via the amount of takedowns he got and the pressure of that he pushed against Pettis. What did you think?
I'm going to play devil's advocate here. I think I had this for Pettis, and here's why. So we talked Condit Lawler last time. I talked about how, you know, I probably gave Condit the third on output, and people have convinced me that, you know, Lawler probably won that because of damage. And if we're talking about the terms they use, effective striking and grappling, okay, so effective means that you did damage or you threatened.
Right.
What did Alvarez do that threatened in the third?
Not much.
You could give him the control category, but as far as effective grappling, he got him down and he got right back up.
Now I'm going to have to pull this back to Dillashaw Cruz for a second. How do you weight Cruz's four takedowns in that fight? Because he didn't hold TJ down.
Oh, I don't think he did either, but I do think he controlled where that fight went better than anybody else. And yeah, you can say, okay, Dillashaw's moving forward, he's got the control.
Right.
But he didn't. He had the control. He moved forward. There were times he threw punches that landed on the cage. Because Cruz was luring him that way.
It was also very weird. He wasn't setting up those kicks. Like, he would have a high kick that went a foot over Cruz's head. like
or a foot away from his head in the front, or 2 feet in the front.
I didn't even mean to get us off track with Alvarez Pettis. But yeah, so to your point, it was not effective grappling.
And if you look at the effective striking, I mean, I don't know if Alvarez landed very much in that third round at all. Pettis landed some nice shots. I mean,
I would have liked to have seen around 4 and 5. I know it wasn't the most exciting fight in the world, but when you have two high-caliber fighters like that, we just talked about the evolution of the sport, and fights are going to be closer. This should have been a fight night main event.
Yeah, fight pass main event.
Yes, exactly. Right.
Yeah, and you know, if you go probably, you know, 3 months ago, it probably was a fight pass main event type fight. But now, because they're pushing fight pass more and more, those five-round main events are no longer these number one contender fights. They're like either big stars like Anderson Silva, or occasionally you throw a title fight in there. I mean,
right.
John Jacek fought for the title on there.
Right. So where do you see both fighters going next? It's pretty interesting. The careers are almost going in opposite spectrums,
yeah,
right?
So I mean, Pettis is going to get somebody decent that he can probably, you know, you would expect him to be a large favorite.
Does he need to go to 45, you think?
I mean,
is he getting bullied at 55?
I think in order for him to be an effective possible champion, he's either got to strengthen his defense or, you know, take down defense or go all the way back down to 45 and work some stuff out there, because they're not going to be as tough of wrestlers, although Mendez is down there.
It's funny, yeah, when Melendez fought him, he did a great job of neutralizing the grappling, but that almost became like the blueprint against him, and then RDA used it, and now Alvarez used it.
Yeah, and I think, I mean, he's got good wrestlers in that camp, too, so you got to
imagine. Ben Askren.
Yeah, Ben Askren has got to be, or at least he should be, drilling more with him, maybe, to try to stop that stuff. But I think he stays, if I were to have to imagine what Pettis does, I bet he stays at 55.
And I'm sorry, I think I cut you off, so who would you...
I'd match him up with somebody like Ian Quinta.
Yeah.
Not Joe Lozon, but somebody like Joe Lozon, even.
Yeah, like a scrappy kind of.
Because he's already
knocked
out Joe Lozon.
Right.
But somebody.
Like a Michael Chiesa, maybe?
Yeah, somebody who's a scrapper.
Right.
And you would imagine Pettis is just going
to
beat him.
Just something to get his mojo back.
But something to get his mojo back. Yeah, and not to feed one of those younger guys to the wolves or those up and coming to the woods. Wolves. But if you give them one of him, they'll see it as an opportunity to vault themselves to the top. He'll see it as an opportunity to get himself back on the right track.
And what do you see for Alvarez next?
So, I mean, right after that decision is read, he instantly is getting the mic and calling for that shot. You've got to be way more impressive than that to get the shot. And don't get me wrong, beating Pettis in any circumstance is impressive, but it was a close decision. I might have had it the other way. Again, looking back at it would probably be much better for me. He's got to beat somebody else. That's not enough.
We're thinking like a Tony Ferguson or a Khabib coming off of injury.
Yeah, either of those two, I'm fine with. I'd also give him he could fight RDA if McGregor by some chance beat him. I'd be fine with that. You know, hell, give him Diaz. Let's see what he does with Diaz.
So a couple of possibilities for Alvarez, but I think we can both agree it's not going to be a title shot right away.
Yeah, I don't see it. Not yet, at least.
The other big names on the card, the main card that is, you had Travis Hoppe Brown and Matt Meathead Mitrione. Obviously, the ugly eye injury for Mitrione in this one.
Yeah, and I've heard people compare it to sci-fi creatures. I've heard people subscribe it to some kind of horror film.
It looks like his eye is blowing a bubble.
So I was a little ways away. My seats weren't cage side, so to speak. It looked like from where I was sitting that maybe his eye had fallen out of its socket. That's how gross looking it was. It was about the size of his eye,
right?
But not his eye.
Now, I think it was confirmed in the post-fight press conference. It was not the eye poke, because Travis Brown had two eye pokes. It was not the eye poke that did it, but rather a punch.
Yeah, but you also can't discount the eye pokes as what probably could have led to that injury, because he said he was seeing double. So if he's seeing double, he's probably more likely to get hit on that side. And he did get hit on that side a bunch of times. That blew up his eye, wound up leading to the end of the fight.
It's a cruel, cruel MMA world. Where do you see Matt Meathead Mitrione going from here? He is a free agent now.
Yeah, I can't imagine. So he said he's willing to walk away from the sport if the UFC doesn't throw a number at him that they like. And I just can't see them.
He's 37 years old.
Yeah,
and why reinvest in this?
Why fawn all over him, just throw a bunch of money at him? He's not going to be champion. I think we can agree at 37 years old, a performance like that against Travis Brown, you can't imagine him beating Cain Velasquez.
No.
Ever. Because, you know, he's getting towards the end of his career. So why would they throw a lot of money at him when they could let him walk? He can make more money in Bellator, and they can make room for somebody like Jared Roshaw, who we have on the show today.
Nice little segue there. And what about Happa? Where do you see him going next?
I mean, he's still going to need a top-tier guy before. I mean, he was ranked, I think, 6, and Mitrione was 14. So that's a fight he's supposed to win. So he's still going to need somebody big before he's like anywhere near a mix.
And I want to say he was as high as 3 at one point, right around the Verdum fight when that was the number one contender fight, or maybe right around his Big Brown beatdown.
I think he was somewhere near there, but the problem was there was a lot of big resurgence of heavyweights that just kind of mucked up his picture. You know, like, so obviously Dos Santos is going to be up there because he's one of the best up there. But Overeem messed that up a lot. Arlovski's win streak messed that up a lot.
Including a win over Travis Brown.
Including a win over Travis. There's like a lot of guys who like had a late career insurgence there and just have kind of gotten in his way. He's going to need to go beat one of those guys now. He's going to need to beat, maybe Dos Santos gets him.
Yeah.
I know they don't like doing the winner versus loser matchup, but I'd imagine Overeem is probably...
In the title mix, maybe, if they don't give it to...
In the title mix, or Miosic's in the title mix. Yeah. Then again, maybe Travis Brown gets the one of those that doesn't get the title shot.
Right.
You know, maybe you go Travis Brown versus Overeem and Miosic gets the title shot.
Or, I'm actually blanking out right now. Who's Rothwell fighting in 2 weeks?
Oh, Rothwell's fighting Josh Barnett.
Yeah, so maybe one of those. Although, actually, Brown already beat Barnett, but...
But maybe you could fight Rothwell if Rothwell manages to win that
right.
by some kind of weird front head choke.
Right. So, that's kind of where we see the two heavyweights going. And as far as the rest of the card...
I thought what stood out about this card more than anything was the amount of replacements, and not just the amount of replacements, because we talked about that last time, but also how well they did.
Yeah.
Right? Because, I mean, don't get me wrong, there's a couple in there that maybe didn't have the best day. Elvis Mutatric, you know, decent showing against Franz Barbarossa, but probably nothing to write home about.
Was what it was. You probably didn't hear it because you were live, but Joe Rogan made fun of the fact that he didn't have a real mouthpiece.
Oh, yeah, that kept falling out. That was weird stuff.
Yeah.
And there was a lot of booing because of that, too, speaking of the boss.
But that's what happens when you take a fight on short notice.
Yep. So the other one that stood out to me, Luke Sanders. What a beast.
Awesome.
Coming up 10 pounds to fight somebody like Maximo Blanco. And I think I said it on our preview show, too. He's dangerous. He's not the kind of guy you want to fight, even if it's on short notice, up 10 pounds.
I also love, you kind of get the twofer in there when he has a knockdown blow, but then it leads to a submission. It's like, hey, you just showed off two really cool things there, knockout power and submissions.
Yeah, I was kind of hoping he went for the Donkey Kong punches there, because that's really what I wanted to see. But he took his back and sunk in the choke, and you have to respect that he was willing to show both pieces off.
And remind me, because it was a late night for one and for all, but the guy who fought Rob Font... our guy, Charles Rosa, he had a great showing, too. The local
Boshniak.
Boshniak, yes. Thank you. Out of Eastern Mass.
Yeah, I mean, so he lost to Charles Rosa, and I think I said on the preview show, back when we still thought it was going to be, I don't know, replacement number two,
yeah.
Augusto Mendez.
Right.
So Augusto Mendez replaced by Kyle Boshniak. I said I don't imagine somebody who's only 6-0 with, like, a decent record could come in and give Rosa all that much trouble. Boshniak did.
Damn, trouble.
I'm pretty sure he won a round, right? It was 29-28 on all the cards. Very stellar showing. He's fun to watch. I'd be happy when they give him another fight.
Yeah, and then obviously Rob Font, so impressive.
He's a beast.
He's a beast. Yeah, keep an eye on him. I would love to see like him versus an Almeida. Those are your two kind of like up-and-coming.
Yeah, well, I mean, along with Aljamain Sterling. And that division just got way, way more exciting because Rob Font in the mix now for sure.
I threw this out there on Twitter as a fighter nickname for Rob Font. What do you think of Rob Bold Font?
Oh, I like Bold. Yeah. Comic Sans Font. Yeah. Rob Comic Sans.
Okay.
Give it a try, Rob.
We just got out of control there. Anyone else impress you as far as the rest of the card? Obviously, Felder with a submission win. Felder? A submission win?
The funny thing about that fight, Felder didn't impress me. Darren Cruikshank impressed me.
Yeah, I think he was winning up to that point.
And the sad thing is, he's probably getting the
act
here.
Yeah,
like, I mean, 3 in a row in a no contest, but that well against Paul Felder, and it's still going to probably cost him his UFC status. sad thing to see from him.
It's a fickle world, I tell you. So yeah, overall, I thought just a great card, top to bottom. You know, pay-per-view caliber, really.
Yeah, fun to be at too.
Yeah, fun, just a fun night of fights. So with that said, I think we're done breaking down Fight Night 81, and we will kick it to our first interview. You got to catch up with Team Takedown star Jared Rochelle.
Yep, and he's doing a little side training elsewhere. So listen in and hear where that might be.
So this is Gumby Vreeland here with Top Turtle MMA, and we're here with Jared Rochelle, who fights at UFC 196, that's February 6th, against Roy Big Country Nelson. Jared, you're only a few weeks out from that event. How's training been, and where are you training right now?
Training's been going really well. I've been up in Colorado, up by Wheat Ridge and Denver area. Training at Grudge Gym with a couple of the heavyweights around here, Josh Copeland and Justin Renz up here, and a few other local heavyweights around here that use their gym, and the training's been going good. Working with their striking coach Jake Ramos and trying to round out my game a little bit more.
Awesome. And Josh Copeland's a former opponent of yours, right? And how is it training with a guy who you used to or have fought against?
It's not too bad. Yeah, I've had to do it before. It's not that big of a deal, you know. With heavyweights, it's come by good training partners and just big athletic guys anyway. So it's kind of, I don't know, you made that contact, and then usually there's a lot of respect towards your opponent whenever you're done. So it's kind of a easy way to ask, hey, you know, whenever you're available sometime, maybe you'd want to come down and train. And it ended up working out to where now if he needs me, he can call me, and if I'm available, I can help him, or vice versa. So it worked out pretty good.
And I know from talking with your manager, you've also brought your coach, Mark Lehman, with you. Has that been something where he's also helping coach up there, or is he there more just for support of you?
No, he was kind of here for support of me and making sure it's when you're going to a new gym and stuff, it's kind of nice to have a coach there with you too, and making sure that, you know, things are run the way that it should be as far as you can get right and everything. Because you hear those stories about people going to gyms and getting teed off on or something. So, but Mark was here for the first week, and now I've got Kenny, the wrestling coach. He's with me this week, and so is one of our other fighters, Chad Scully, who's a 45-pounder in the UFC. So we're just up here, you know, trying to see some new workout partners and see different striking coaches.
Awesome. So I'm going to ask a question kind of about a sensitive subject, and feel free to react to it as you want. Obviously, the big news out of your gym recently has been Johnny Hendricks leaving to train elsewhere. Have you felt like you have gotten an increased focus on yourself from the coaches at your own gym? Or is it like kind of caused a little bit of a distraction leading into your fight?
No distraction at all for me. It's, you know, Johnny kind of did things, you know, went to the beat of his own drum, you know, even before he left. So it was never that big of a deal before. My workouts are my workouts, and I schedule my schedule the way that I wanted it, and he did it his way. And, you know, we were on the same team and stuff, but really it was just kind of more high and by whenever I'd see him, and that's about it. There was no reason for him to be in the gym when I was there. So, you know, it's not really a big deal. It is what it is, and, you know, time marches on.
Makes sense to me. So moving on to your past results, me and my co-host were talking the other day about really underappreciated win streaks, and you've put together a 3-fight win streak in a heavyweight division that's a little bit thin at the top right now. Do you think the matchmakers have overlooked you a little bit with the ability to move you up faster and faster?
No, you know, I've thought that they've done a pretty good job. You know, I think it's kind of a bad thing sometimes whenever guys go on win streaks and they push them too far too fast. I think I could go higher. I think they could have taken me up faster, and I think I'd have done all right. But I think they've taken me up
just fine, and I've got to get better in certain areas. So it's been a gradual increase in competition and in my ranking and stuff. So I'm okay with it. You know, when I get my striking stuff figured out, whenever I've got my coaching and stuff figured out just right, I'll be ready for that push. I'll be asking for that push, for them to push harder for me, and it'll show in my fights as well.
So you mentioned a little bit about working on your striking and trying to make sure that you get your striking when you could. Now, your opponent, Roy Nelson, has notoriously got a thunderous overhand right. Does that affect the way that you're game planning this game? Are you thinking, if you could give us just a little bit of insight, are you thinking that this is, you got to turn this into a wrestling match?
No, not necessarily. I mean, everybody that I study the videos and stuff of his fights and everything, you know, Roy's very tough everywhere. He's got really good balance for a big guy, and he's very, very durable. He's good on the ground. He's a black belt. He knows how to stay out of positions, and he like you said, he has dynamite in both his hands. So, you know, there is no real good game plan. It's just avoid that big right hand, watch his left hand too, because he's got power there also, and you know, get my shots in where I can, and if it goes to the ground, that's fine. But I don't really have a specific, I have to do this. Of course, you know, there's a way I would like for it to go, but you never know until you're out there.
That's right. So he is notoriously kind of a fan favorite, bringing that, like, everyman image to the UFC. Do you think that a win over him is a bigger move up the rankings and a bigger move in the status of viewers than Stefan Struve, or would you say that Stefan Struve was a bigger name for you?
No, I definitely think Roy Nelson's a bigger name for me. He's ranked higher. He's been, you know, he's been around forever, it seems like, in the UFC, and you know, he's a veteran, and a lot of people follow him and stuff. It's going to be right there in Vegas where he trains, where he stays. So it's definitely Roy Nelson's a bigger fight for me than the Struve one was, but it's a huge opportunity.
Do you think that fighting close to his hometown gives him a slight advantage? I know you've been fighting really far away from your hometown. You fought in Melbourne in front of, I believe it was 53,000 people. Does that affect you, moving really far away from home every single time you fight?
No, not really. It's one of my favorite things about what I do is getting to go and see the other places in the world. Like, you know, with the UFC and everything, I like what I do and stuff, but probably one of the single best parts of doing it is I've gotten to go see parts of the world, you know, and take people with me. And it's been such a great experience, places that I would never go to ever in my life, probably, if it weren't for it. So anytime they ask me to travel for a fight, I'm all on board, and I want to do it. I'm grateful to do it.
All right. So one more question about your matchup with him. So a lot of people have felt, have very mixed feelings about Roy Nelson. After he wins, he rubs his belly, which sometimes kind of, if you could excuse the pun, rubs people the wrong way. There seems to be this love-hate relationship with him. Do you have any personal opinions on him, or is it all strictly business?
No, it's strictly business. I think a guy like Roy, you know, is kind of like what you said. It's kind of like, I don't know, he seems kind of like a man's man, I guess. Just looks kind of like average Joe, and has special abilities behind that image. And I have nothing but good things to say about him. The guy's durable. He's tough. He's one of the tougher guys to put away in all of UFC, in my opinion.
Absolutely, especially with some of those shots he takes from some of those big guys.
Yes.
Final question I have for you today. Stipe Miocic the other day went out, beat Andrei Arlovsky in under a minute, and we saw him shouting at Dana White, notoriously kind of a quieter guy, shouting at Dana White, and now there's talk about him getting a title shot. In this day and age, with all of this media push and to try to get sell fights, do you ever feel any pressure to be a little bit more vocal? Because you are a quiet guy.
You know, I think it's very important. I think it's really important to, you know, to be able to do that when the time is right. You know, I think Miocic, he waited for the right moment to do it, and it was kind of like, hey, you know, there's nowhere else I can really go here to prove it, you know, and he got emotional about it, and he deserved that opportunity to do that, and I'm happy for him and that he's going to get what he deserves. But, you know, I hear from a lot of people, like, man, you should say this or do that, and it's just, you know, I'm not really that type, you know, and when I feel like I've really earned it and I feel like I'm at that point, like where Miocic is, you know, I'll let my voice be heard, but until then, I'll just kind of stay humble and just keep plugging away.
And at that point in time, we get to hear the big show yell, huh?
Yeah, that's right.
All right. Well, do you have anything else for our listeners before we let you go here, Jared?
No, I just want to say thank you for having me on, and I've been working really hard on trying to round out my game and better on my feet and make it as exciting as I can, and I'm looking forward to UFC February 6th.
All right, and we will all be watching. So thank you very much again, Jared. Have a wonderful night.
You too. Thank you.
Pretty interesting stuff there, Gumby, especially on the inner workings of Team Takedown. Before we react to that, we will cut to your interview with light heavyweight prospect Misha Serpinov.
This is Gumby Vreeland here with Misha Serkinov, who fights at UFC 196 February 6th against Alex Nicholson, who's a UFC newcomer. Misha, how's the training going leading into this fight?
Good. You know, I'm always training. I'm kind of one of those guys that, you know, I'm always at the gym. I like the sport, and, you know, I'm always doing something, and yeah, just trying to get better as a mixed martial artist. You know, learn a couple new things every day and try to apply them when I fight.
And you're training at Extreme Couture now, correct?
Yeah, I train at Extreme Couture. That's where I do most of my sparring. But whenever I can, you know, I also, you know, I visit some other places as well.
Yeah, so you're doing most of your fight camp there at Couture. I've also heard that you're coaching there. So how is that that play into some of your training?
Yeah, I also teach Brazilian Jiu-Jitsu with no gi. So I do that there. And, you know, I have a bunch of great guys that show up and grapple. And, you know, so I do that on the side as well. So it kind of goes hand to hand, you know. I train myself and then I get to coach a little bit. And the stuff that I show, I actually apply on my students. And a lot of them, they like it, you know, because they see, you know, it's effective, and they actually see someone being able to apply it. And, you know, just we have, like, a bunch of good guys and just trying to work together, and all of us, we're trying to get better.
Awesome. And you definitely applied those in your first fight with Daniel Jolly. Absolutely dominant performance. But following up on that, they're giving you another guy on his UFC debut. Did you feel like that was a little bit of a slap in the face, that they didn't step you up a little bit higher, or were you just happy to get the call to fight again?
Yeah, I know. I'm like, me personally, I just had my first fight in UFC, and reality is, like, a lot of people don't know who I am, right? So I don't know, maybe that's why I'm getting also guys that are not really known. Maybe they're trying to kind of, like, you know, because the thing is, the 205 division, there's a lot of fighters now, and so they're just trying to see, I guess, who stands where. I know UFC signed a whole bunch of new 205ers, so that there's a new pool of fighters. And it's just exciting, you know. Like, me personally, like, I don't know who is who yet. You know, there's, like, a lot of top guys with great records that fight at 205. And like I said, you know, like, everyone's asking, well, who do you want to fight? Who do you want to fight? And I said, like, I want to fight everybody. Like, you know, there's, like, a lot of 205ers. And obviously, the end of the goal is to be fighting, you know, guys top 10, and, you know, that's everyone knows who those guys are, and, you know, you're gonna get a lot of fame for it, and, you know, and et cetera, et cetera. But I just got signed in UFC as well, so this is just my second fight, the way I look at it. So I don't really care who they give me. I'm just very I'm very happy to be part of such a great organization that put up such amazing fights, you know. So I'm super pumped, like, fighting in Vegas, you know what I mean? Like, yeah. I honestly, like, a year and a half ago, I would never even, like, think, never mind that I'll be fighting in UFC, never mind I'm going to be, like, on the same card with Cain Velasquez and Verdum, you know. Like, for me, it's a huge accomplishment as it is already, and I'm just looking forward to see how far I can go in a mixed martial arts world, you know?
Yeah, and it is certainly an accomplishment, especially to be named with some of those guys on the same card. So we won't be that next media outlet who asks you who you want next. But do you have, like, a game plan for the year? Like, how many times you want to fight? You know, how much time you need off in between fights? Is there any thought process behind that and where you want to be at the end of the year?
Yeah, you know, last year my goal was I started the year really, really kind of, like, productive. I had a whole bunch of fights right away. But pretty much halfway through the year, I pretty much, like, in August, that was my third fight, and I was looking for a fourth. It didn't work out, so I only had three. And, you know, it was a good, productive year, three fights. Like, a lot of people, you know, some people have more than three fights. For me, having three fights in a year is you know, it's very productive. It's very busy year. Because remember, you got to stay injuries-free. We all get injured when we spar, when we train. And then, you know, who knows what can happen in this life, too. And if you can make yourself fight three times a year, that's amazing. And this year, I'm going to try to do exact same as last year. And, you know, and we'll see how that goes. This is going to be my first one this year. And then, I'll be looking forward to, I know UFC is coming to Toronto, I believe. That's what I heard. So I'm from Toronto originally myself, and I know a lot of people that, you know, a lot of people know me in the city. So I just think that, you know, if everything goes according to plan and, you know, the way I plan, and next one will be in Toronto, and I would love to be kind of not on those prelim cards, but a little bit more, you know, fighting in my city. Everyone knows who I am, so maybe on one of those kind of main cards that kind of everyone tunes in for, you know. So, like, I would love to be maybe somewhere like that, you know, this year, sometime this year, and then who knows, you know, and then we'll see how it goes. I like to train. I train all the time, and we'll see how it goes.
Yep. So you mentioned trying to get the move up onto the main card. It slowly turned into a little bit of an entertainment organization in that they're looking for people who sell their fights. You're a pretty quiet guy. You've mentioned that, you know, not a lot of people in the UFC know you who are. Is that something you've considered, like, starting to talk a little bit more, getting your name out there a little bit more so that people do recognize you and do ask for you to be on the main card?
Yeah, that's why I was very eager to fight again. I wanted to fight originally December 10th or December 11th, one of those Vegas cards. Remember those three cards in three nights. Yeah. So I knew it's gonna get crazy busy and it's crazy entertaining. So I try to get on that just to get some of the fame along some of the other, like, superstars that they have them there. So then they work out, and then I was very, very happy to hear that they are asking me to join also a Vegas show, and just a couple of months later, which was really, really impressive. So I think the way everything is happening, yes, a lot of people don't know who I am, but here I am fighting in MGM Grand, in front of the whole world, in the fight capital of the world, and I'm pretty sure after that day, a lot more people will know who I am.
Well, if it's anything like your first performance, that's definitely true. Speaking of people we don't know too much about, Alex Nicholson making his UFC debut against you on February 6th in the MGM Grand. How much have you seen film on Nicholson? Do you know anything about him? What's kind of the game plan going into this one?
Yeah, I know. Obviously, like, I've seen pretty much everything there is online, and some of his fights, and, you know, he's a big guy. He's an athlete. He's a strong guy. He throws hard, and he's a little bit unpredictable a little bit in a way. You know, he's one of those guys that he doesn't look like it, but all of a sudden he can hit you with a spinning back fist, and, you know, he's a tough guy. You know, he's a scrapper, so. But, you know, it's his debut, and we'll see. You know, I'm confident. I'm training hard with, like, you know, a lot of good guys, and we'll see. We'll see who the better guy is.
Yep. So switching topic off of your fight just a little bit, I saw you had a little jab on Twitter that the fine people at USADA stopped by to collect some of your urine. Is that something that – so obviously you don't worry about it for yourself, but is that something you worry about in the sport, about being – clean, or is that something that's just now part of the occupation now that you're part of UFC?
No, you know what? I'm extremely, extremely happy. It's almost like, you know, things kind of like shift the right way on its own time. You cannot force things. And it's almost like I feel like with my MMA career and with me being in UFC, I really try to be in UFC a lot sooner. And, you know, I kind of had to really prove that I belong in UFC and really... I really had to fight to get my chance to be in UFC, you know. I really had to prove. I had to beat some veterans, you know. So now that all these changes happen, it's amazing because the sport gets cleaned up. So now I'm more confident in my skills because I know that my opponent, he's not going to be on any kind of performance enhancements. So It's almost because it's a fight already, and going into a fight knowing that someone might be like sauced or something, it's always at the back of your head, you know, because you don't know how strong they can get unnaturally, right? So that's what I'm saying. I'm just happy when things shift in the right time in terms of now we have USADA testing all the fighters, you know, so it's a little bit safer. Now you're not gonna have those crazy, you know, guys testing positive like 27-1, like testosterone ratio, something insane. So it makes it a little bit more fair, and we're gonna really see real talent, and we're really gonna see people that train hard. And I really hope that USADA tests everyone every single fight. Like, I don't, like, you know, if you fight in UFC, boom, right away. You want to fight, boom, right away. You want to fight in UFC before even you go in the fight, just collect a sample, you know?
Yeah, and I think that is the way that they're moving with that too.
Yeah, and now, it is. I was talking to them, and that's exactly what they said. That's exactly what they want to do. And it, just me as a fighter, as an athlete, makes me feel really, really kind of proud of my organization that they actually do that. And I can say very clearly that's the only organization that does that, you know? So I'm happy to be part of organization that does that.
Yeah, that's awesome. And was it really invasive, or was it just like quick, they're in, they're out, and it's over?
Oh, you know what? I was actually, because the thing is, the day before, I had to give blood for the blood work to get licensed. So literally the next day at 7 a.m., I have a knock on the door, really loud knock on the door, and I was just sleeping. I was like dreaming. I thought like, oh my God, like is someone really knocking on the door? So I wasn't even sure what was going on. I was so sleepy and kind of like in a dream, you know, I wasn't even sure what was going on. And then they came in, they're like, oh yeah, yeah. And right away I was like, is this a dream or are they really here? And they were here, and then, yeah, they were really, really cool. They're really nice people, all polite, all, you know, very nice.
They just happen to surprise you when you're in the middle of sleeping and ask you for your urine.
yeah. And I actually opened the door. I only had like just a blanket over me. And yeah, I was like, oh, you know, I was like, okay. I was not expecting any visitors, you know. But yeah, no, they're really, really cool. Well, really cool.
That certainly seems like a less fun surprise, I assume, because the testing went well, that it's less of a imposition.
You know, as soon as like they were here, I was just like, oh, this is cool, because, you know, I've been competing my whole life, and once you get tested, you really know, like, you know, you're a pro athlete, you know, and they really want to make sure if you're real or not, which is cool.
It's like that welcome to the show moment.
Yeah, it's beautiful. It's like, okay, they want to see if you're a real athlete, and, you know. And now, okay, you are. Well, welcome to Vegas. Well, so
that's certainly awesome. So we're running a little bit low on time, but before we let you go, we'd love to give you just a couple of seconds to boost your sponsors or say anything that's gonna get people out there watching your Alex Nicholson fight. So anything you want to tell your fans before we're off the air?
Yeah, just, you know, like, obviously, you know, these days, the more following you have, the better it is as a fighter, and, you know, the more people mention your name anywhere, the better it is as a fighter. So, you know, if people can follow me on Twitter, Misha_Serkinov, or ideally on even Instagram at MishaC911, that would be awesome. And I really appreciate all the fans, because the fans, those are the people that talk about us, and those people that tune in into watching us fight. And I really appreciate for all the people that would tune in and watch my fight. So I just want to say, you know, thank you for all the people that support me.
Yeah, and I certainly think after one more of those performances like last time, people are going to be talking a lot more. So thank you again, Misha, for stopping by and chatting with us.
Thank you.
We really appreciate it.
Thank you very much for your time.
So there you have it. Light heavyweight prospect Misha Cirkunov. Not very well known, but I think he will become known as we go along here.
Yeah, I think that fight with Daniel Jolly showed us a lot of stuff. He's a really, really, and if you heard the interview, really polite guy.
Nice guy.
Yeah.
Nice guy.
Super, super nice. The story about answering the door in his birthday suit, certainly hilarious. And it's like that, like, under-the-cover funny. He's like, pun intended, under-the-cover funny. Doesn't necessarily shove it right in your face, but he's a funny guy, very entertaining, and I think we're going to be seeing a lot of him.
Yeah, agreed. And then, rewinding it back here a second to the interview prior, this was my big takeaway. So Jared Rochelle and Johnny Hendricks didn't train together at Team Takedown.
So I didn't want to poke too much in there because he seemed a little bit like he might not want to answer a whole lot of questions about Johnny Hendricks, and albeit that makes a lot of sense. He's got a huge fight coming up. He should be talking about himself. He should be talking about his camps. But yeah, he said he didn't hardly ever train with Johnny Hendricks, which is weird in a camp the size of Team Takedown.
And that's my whole point, too. I'm not trying to be like a TMZ girl about this. Like, these two, they're not really friends, that kind of thing. But it is interesting because, you know, you hear a Mike Goldberg as a fighter's walking to the cage. He's part of XYZ gym, so he trains with XYZ and blah, blah, blah. I just always assumed that Hendricks was wrestling with Jared Rochelle because they were both at Team Takedown.
And let's count off the people we know who train at Team Takedown, too. So we know Johnny Hendricks. We know Jared Rochelle. That's two. We also know
Not Johnny Hendricks anymore.
But at the time, Chaz Kelly, who we – fun prospect at 45. You also have Jared's brother, Jake.
Mm-hmm.
Who I don't know if he still trains there, but he definitely doesn't fight anymore. He hasn't fought in quite a while. And Shane Roller, who I'm pretty sure retired as well. So we're talking about three really big-name pro fighters, two guys who probably retired, and I'm sure they fill out their camp with like a bunch of other guys fighting for promotions, but those are the names we know. So as far as names we know, if Jared Rochelle is not training with Johnny Hendricks, who is?
Right.
Who was training with Johnny Hendricks ever?
And was that part of the reason why he left? I don't know.
Yeah, I don't know if he's looking for more competition.
It's always interesting, though, with the fighter camps and who chooses to train with who. Obviously.
Yeah, and obviously, so you could say the same thing about Jared Rochelle, but as we heard from the interview, he's taking it up to grunge. He's working with Trevor Whitman. He's working with a bunch of different guys up there to get his game to the next level and working with, you know, they have lots of heavyweights up there. They've always had lots of heavyweights up there. You know, Shane Carwin used to train up there. Brendan Schaub used to train up there. They got some names up at grunge, and they always will have some names up at grunge.
I have to imagine it's very tough for a heavyweight, too. First of all, there aren't a lot of heavyweight athletes walking the face of the earth to begin with. There aren't a lot in the UFC. I mean, we were talking about this off air. You go to the 155-pound division, there are 94 fighters signed to the UFC.
Just in the UFC.
And it makes sense, though, right? Because the average person in this world is, you know, maybe 170 pounds and 5'10".
Yeah.
And now, okay, so those guys are cutting down to 155. It makes sense that there are a ton of fighters in that weight class. There aren't a lot of big dogs in the yard.
Yeah, and even talking about that, so you guys obviously can't see at home. You don't have cameras watching us right now. I'm about 6'3". I walk around at about 205 pounds. When I compete, I usually compete down around middleweight, down around 185. So even a guy who's like a little bit on the larger side like me, is still not even close to heavyweight. I'm 6'3". That's well above average. So, yeah, I think you're seeing that heavyweight is coming up a little short on people to train with, which, again, just begs the question. If Johnny Hendricks is walking around at 205, 210, why is he not training with his training partner at 250? Like, that seems like the next closest logical guy to train with Jared Rochelle. So, there's got to be something there.
Yeah, a very, very interesting part of the interview right there for me if I wanted to play conspiracy theorist. So, awesome second episode, Gumby. Who do we have to thank for getting us on the air here?
So, in addition to thanking Grappler's Toolbox, who we popped by before, remember, 15% off. If you entered Manifesto into the bonus code.
Enter Manifesto, people. Come on, just go to Grappler's Toolbox, type in Manifesto. Get yourself 15% off.
And we also have to again thank Sisu Mouthpieces. So, once again, one of those situations where you could use a Sisu mouthpiece.
You're at your gym, you're training MMA, or maybe you're just doing a little submission grappling, and after you finish a roll with someone who has a mouth guard in, they want to talk to you about that roll, but they have a mouthpiece in. So it sounds something like, good guillotine. But you can't understand them because they have a mouthpiece in and they want to break down what just happened, but I can't understand them.
So the perfect solution to that is to get yourself a Sisu mouthpiece. They're not only breathable, but your training partner can talk to you and you'll understand them. So maybe get them one as a gift. It'd be a great gift for that guy you roll with.
Exactly. All right, so the email address is topturtlemma@gmail.com. The Twitter is @topturtlemma. Gumby, plug your shit.
My Twitter handle is @GumbyVreeland. And make sure you stop by at MMA-manifesto.com for all your latest news and some other fun countdown articles as well.
All right, when you get to the top turtle position in MMA, you should always be looking to finish. We are Top Turtle, and we are finished.